Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee 1, Public Hearing, May 29, 1985. Bills to be considered are House Bills 2253, Senate Bill 400, House Bill 2660, SCR 13, House Bills 2642, and 2331.
I intend to follow our printed agenda unless someone advises me that there's a scheduling problem. Well, I know we've got a couple people who aren't going to be able to join us until later in the afternoon on the consecutive sentencing issue. First bill I'd like to take up is 2253, which had been tabled earlier. The reason it's been brought up is to consider amendments regarding pre-sentence reports, which will be and have been distributed to members. So the chair would move that 2253 be removed from the table for the purposes stated. Is there any objection to that? If not, 2253 is taken from the table. I'd like to ask those who are here on the issue of amendments to 2253 and provisions relating to pre-sentence reports, please come forward to the witness table, whoever you may be, and be sure to identify yourselves, and we'll be more than glad to take the appropriate action. Whatever that may be.
I didn't get here.
This is suspicious already.
Mr. Chairman. Well.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for your record, my name is Hardy Myers, 900 Southwest Fifth Avenue, Portland. And I'm appearing today as chair of the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project. We made a presentation to the full committee at the beginning of the session at which we explained the genesis of the project and its purpose. Briefly, Oregon last year was one of a very small number of states selected for a National Institute of Corrections grant to study the causes and possible solutions of overcrowding in our local correction system. Oregon had similarly been chosen 2 years earlier for the prison overcrowding project with a parallel structure of funding, and the report of that effort, of course, was submitted or made public since the beginning of the legislative session. The jail project in its first year has been concentrating on the pretrial phase of the local corrections process. And in reviewing, however, the post-trial phase, one portion of that, the pre-sentence investigation and report preparation process, was viewed by the project as an area in which legislative action this session might be appropriate. This is really one of only two legislative proposals the project has this session. Its proposals will really be coming forward, for the most part, in 87. To put it briefly in context, it's already the belief of the project that there will be a number of changes of an administrative or judicial nature, which are not world-shaking, which do not involve radical legislative judgments, that may go far to improving the use of our present jail capacity, making it more efficient. One of those deals with attempting to streamline and simplify the pretrial or pre-sentence investigation and report process, during which time a number of sentenced offenders are occupying jail space awaiting the completion and submission of that report. That is, in brief, the background of this proposal, and I'd like now to ask Mr. Snyder, who is one of the staff persons working with the project, if he would explain in a little more detail the background of the bill and its contents.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project. As Mr. Myers has indicated, preliminarily, the members of the project identified the pre-sentence report and the manner in which it's prepared as one of the issues that we might be able to address to make the process more efficient. In keeping with that, an advisory committee was established, including Judge Robert Jones, Circuit Judge in Multnomah County, Chalmers Jones representing the State Parole Board, Pat Garris representing the Corrections Division, a representative of Mike Shrunk's office representing the Multnomah County District Attorney, and other staff members of our project. In reviewing the way the pre-sentence report is prepared and the information that's included within it, that advisory group drew some conclusions that the policy group later identified as appropriate for legislation. First of all, it was identified that often the pre-sentence report is not needed at the time of sentencing at all. In other cases, when the pre-sentence report is prepared, there's some or a lot of the information that's included within it that's not necessary at the time of sentencing. But that in identifying which parts of it are necessary, it's more important to go on a case-by-case basis, because depending upon the circumstances of that case or that particular defendant, different portions of the pre-sentence report might be more important than others. We identified that the parole board in every case needs all the information that's included within the pre-sentence report so that the board can make a value judgment as to whether or not to grant parole and at what point to grant parole to a given individual. We also identify that there's a great amount of Corrections Division field staff work that's associated with developing data for the pre-sentence report. In conjunction with all those factors, we developed this legislation. I'd like to identify for you just basically what the factors are that it changes. First, under current law, a pre-sentence report is ordered every time a felony conviction occurs unless all the parties to the case waive the report. This measure would provide that a pre-sentence report would be ordered only when one of the three parties to the case asked for it, either the prosecution or the defendant or the judge. It goes on to say that even when the pre-sentence report is ordered, apart from the statutory requirements of what it must include, that being the matrix calculations and the statement, if any, of the victim, that everything beyond that should be provided on a menu approach rather than having everything provided altogether. So the net effect of the legislation is to say, over and above the statutorily required data, that the judge can order any or all of the additional information that the report provides in consultation with the parties, that being the defense and the district attorney. Finally, it provides that the agency that would have authority to establish the format for the pre-sentence report would be changed from the parole board with the advice of the Commission on Prison Standards and Parole to the Corrections Division with the advice of the Parole Board and the Commission on Prison Standards. The purpose of that change would be to provide an expedited way for the Corrections Division to dovetail the information that it can now develop by computer with the format that the report follows. But it's important to emphasize that in each of these cases, the purpose of the legislation is to ensure that the parole board gets all the information that it needs in order to make its informed decision. As Mr. Myers indicated, the Jail Overcrowding Project consists of a balanced group of people representing both state and local government and representing all three of the branches of government, the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. I'd like to emphasize that all the members of the policy group endorse this proposal, including those members of the judiciary, those members representing prosecutors' offices, and those members representing defense attorneys' offices. It's also endorsed at this juncture by several different agencies and organizations, most of which are represented here. So I'd like to turn it over at this point to the others, Mr. Chair, so that they can indicate their views.
Okay, why don't we hold questions until we've heard from others at the witness table. Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chalmers Jones, a member of the Board of Parole. As Mr. Snyder indicated, I represented the parole board on the subcommittee that dealt with this, and certainly the pre-sentence investigation report, time spans involved, etc., have been something of a difficulty for a number of years. First, of course, is the normal time that data collection is needed, and that simply is because they have always compiled the entire report at the time of sentencing, and in those cases, especially where the possible action was probation, that multitude of information was simply not needed. But the time span involved, as Mr. Myers stated, kept the individual in the county jail, even if probation was the idea or commitment to a felony institution. Now, the parole board fully supports this approach because it does indicate that when there is a commission to the custody of the corrections division and the person is of course turned over to one of the penal institutions and we have to do the prison term hearing and set the release date, we will get the full pre-sentence investigation report. And I think with that advent, with the advent of that process, we're not concerned, first of all, by the fact that we no longer will have authority over construction and as to how the document will look. That's a very insignificant part of it. We're not necessarily exhibiting pride of authorship here. It's just simply not that important. So for that particular reason, one, it lessens the impact on the courts, and certainly we're concerned about that as it relates to time elements. And two, it still ensures that we will have input in the document to emerge as a result of this legislation if it is successful. And finally, we will still be able to receive the entire amount of information that we need. So again, for those purposes, we fully endorse this proposed legislation.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions at this point? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, I think, Paul, you were talking earlier about the jail overcrowding project, and it was well represented around the, from people around the state. Was there anyone from Eastern Oregon or Southern Oregon on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, we do have Senator Timms representing Eastern Oregon and Judge Buzz Sawyer from Jackson County representing Southern Oregon.
Thank you.
Also, I might, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson. Commissioner Hansel of Umatilla County is also on the project.
Thank you.
Okay, I noticed we got a repealer here. You may have covered this, but I missed it. What's 144.795?
Mr. Chair, that section is the one that says that the pre-sentence report will be provided in all cases unless it's waived by all three of the parties.
Okay, and the amendments you've made to 790
cover that.
Okay. Are there further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, would you be so good as to pick up the sign-up sheet on this bill 2253 and share it with me? Very kind. Thank you. Mr. Watson, if you wish to be joined by any folks, that's fine.
Chairman of the Record on Log Box Administrator of the Correction Division, I really have nothing further to add. The division is aware of the provisions of this bill. Pat Garris, who is the Assistant Administrator in charge of Field Services, participated in its development. We're prepared to do the job that it calls for, and I think it can improve the process, speed it up, save jail space, and still provide the same level of information to all parties. So we support the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Sandrock?
One question.
Let me take the question first.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. We spoke yesterday about this, and I think you explained that already within the Corrections Division budget, this would be taken care of. I guess maybe the question I wanted to ask, and you may have answered it and I've forgotten, is there a savings in terms of money on this bill, or is it pretty much a wash?
It's pretty much a wash. Our analysis is that we'll do a few fewer perhaps because of the removal of the mandatory. But with automation and moving the information on pre-sentences throughout the state, that whatever savings we would have either in time in terms of the less time to prepare or the fewer reports would be required to do the automation and moving of the information.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Sandrock?
Mr. Chair, Pete Sandrock, representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association. We support the bill.
Okay. That's the kind of testimony we appreciate. Judge Bonebrake, have you had a chance to look at this proposal, or would you have any comment at this time on behalf of the judiciary?
Good idea. Okay. I read it some time ago, and I'm Al Bonebrake, a circuit court judge, and frankly, it sounds like the testimony I gave on a similar bill during the last session had to do with the omnibus sentencing bill we had. We called it, and there was a provision in there that dealt with pre-sentence reports, and they're just not necessary in every case, and it, frankly, it's a waste of resource in a number of cases where they're prepared. There are a number of cases where certain specialized information is needed and other information isn't. And with a PAT dictated form, so to speak, of requiring the same information in every particular case, there is waste. And I think this is a very good idea. And, I haven't talked to a lot of judges about it, but I'm sure that most judges would support the bill.
Great. Thank you very much, Judge. Any questions? Anyone else who wished to testify on 2253 as amended or proposed to be amended? Okay, if not, the chair is prepared and ready to go into work session if members of the subcommittee feel that this is something we can act on today and get moving. Representative Phillips?
Perhaps to start it, we'd have to
adopt the amendment.
Adopt the amendment, so I would move the adoption of amendments to 2253.
Okay, Representative Phillips moves adoption of the amendments to House Bill 2253, which basically replaced the printed bill with new material amending ORS 144790 and repealing ORS 144795 as previously described and proposed by the Association of Oregon Counties. Is there further discussion? Is there objection to the proposed amendment and a motion? If not, they're adopted. Representative Phillips?
I'd like to move the adopted version of House Bill 2253 to full committee. Do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Phillips moves House Bill 2253 as amended to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Spray? Aye. Motion's adopted. Council, can we see this at Monday's full committee?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks to all who came down and assisted with those amendments. Okay, Senate Bill 400. Representative Young, I understand that you're here to testify on that bill.
Well, as long as the House is here, I guess we shouldn't move the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know what he's going to ask you.
Members of the subcommittee, I'm here addressing an issue that I'm not very familiar with and have no first-hand knowledge of, but I've never let that stop me before. May as well jump in with both feet. I have some proposed amendments that will address some problems that have been brought to me with this bill, and possibly they're not real problems, but I'll give you in general terms what is a concern with this bill and with the circumstances that exist presently. It's my understanding that it's relatively easy to get a restraining order when you're in a separation situation, and one of the people can go to the court and say, I fear for my health and safety, and I think that my former spouse or the person I was living with could do me or my children bodily harm, and so I would like to have the court step in and say this person cannot have contact. The problems that have been brought to me are the cases of where one of the spouses, they have been living together, and maybe one has been operating a business out of the home or has a small farm operation or a large farm operation. There's a parting of the ways. The one
person goes and gets a restraining order, and automatically that person is denied access to his livelihood or her livelihood because he cannot make contact and cannot go on those premises. To solve this, I think that we should have a mechanism to resolve this temporary restraining situation as quickly as possible, and at the same time protect all the parties that are involved in it. And the suggestions that I've brought is number one, returning the original language of the bill in section one, because I didn't see a sense in broadening that to somebody that you may have lived with some time ago, and broadening the number of people that can get these restraining orders. I do think that on page two, under section three, the 14-day period is acceptable. But I would suggest that on line 10, after the there under period, that it say, at the hearing, the petitioner shall have the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence an immediate and present danger of abuse to the petitioner. In other words, this person would have to come forward and more than make an accusation that I fear for my health and safety, this person has threatened me, or I have a situation here that I want the court to intercede in. This person would have to come forward and present evidence that this could happen. And then further down on line 18, 19, 20 in there, to return the original language, which would say that the restraining order could be in effect up to 1 year and not automatically 1 year. Because that it seems to me this is something that should be subject to review periodically and not have an arbitrary time period put on it. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions, or you certainly have looked at this issue and other issues more closely than I have, and perhaps there's something wrong with that. I am a signer on the bill originally, and I certainly go along with the concept of doing what we need to do to minimize the chance for any kind of abuse in a situation where people are separated and under a great deal of emotional strain and certainly in a very adversarial position, and I'm sympathetic to that, but I would like to see some changes, particularly for people that have a financial interest in the home and the furnishings and other things that are in the home, and particularly in a business situation where they may need to get access to records or equipment or something of that nature, and they're really precluded from doing that as I understand how things generally function. And I think to get an accusation is one thing, but I think that there should be some burden of proof that there is a situation here that is a real potentially abusive situation.
Okay, thank you. Just, I believe we all have been provided with a copy of your amendment, sir, SB 400A-2.
Right.
Okay.
And this legislative council said if those were accepted, that would take out section one, since there'd be no change there whatsoever.
Okay.
And I just asked the committee to take my concerns into context of the other things that you're looking at in this bill and others, and I do think it is a legitimate concern. And I trust the fairness of the chair and the subcommittee in looking at these issues.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe I'm a little fuzzy on how it works now, and I don't know if the question's directed to you, Representative Young, or to someone on the committee. You talked about the person would have to present evidence that abuse would happen. Do they not now have to present evidence of any kind? I mean, maybe the question I'm asking now is a restraining order just going in and saying there's a good possibility of abuse?
My understanding is that
it's the court is approached and basically goes on the word of the petitioner. And the reason for that is that it is supposed to be a temporary situation, and from the state standpoint, I think it's important to avoid any abusive situation. And my concern is that they move it along to a point where there has to be some proof. One instance that was brought up, and apparently it's a delaying tactic, is where a spouse can accuse the other spouse of abusing the children sexually. And this goes along for a period, and there's a charge made, and then that delays the time of hearing and getting to the bottom of something, and then another charge can be made when it actually gets into a hearing process again, and that can extend it. And that it's used as a delaying tactic to actually get down to whether there should be a restraining order or not. And because of the seriousness of the charge, I can understand the court saying we don't want to take a chance on this. But I think it can be used as a delaying tactic, too.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, so is the idea that all evidence would be heard at one hearing? Is that the implication behind this bill, that someone couldn't say, you know, there's a problem of sexual abuse, and then 2 weeks later say there's a problem of you know, physical abuse to myself or whatever?
My feeling would be to have an opportunity as quickly as possible to get into a hearing process where you have the person that's accusing you of either having done something or possibly doing something, and a chance to either prove or disprove that that mm-hmm. fear.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Nita Paulson.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Anita Paulson. I work at Legal Services, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I left a bit earlier an incredible packet of stuff. I promise you I will not read all of it, but I know that some of you do not have a lot of familiarity with the Family Abuse Prevention Act, and it is a fairly complicated body of law at this point. So what I did is I've done a training handbook called Decoding the Family Abuse Prevention Act, and what I did on one side is take the statute and try and say it over in English on the other side, what the legislature since 1977 in its process of amending this has tried to do. The second thing that I've submitted to you, is labeled Exhibit 2, is a document that I wrote for the Governor's Commission on Women for their handbook, which tells possible victims of domestic violence what the law is and how to work it, and what sorts of protections are available to them under the Act. It's the shortest, simplest thing that I have on, you know, how the law works. And the last document that I've submitted is testimony of Annette Jolin from last session and a copy of a study that she did. She is a former Portland city police officer and worked on the beat for several years, and then went back to school and has done her master's and doctorate work on the Family Abuse Prevention Act and a study on how Oregon's law has worked, and has concluded this was done 2 years ago, that domestic homicides in Oregon are down 10% in a time when they could be expected to go up. And since the homicide statistics are the only firm statistics that she had, because we don't separate out stats on assault sorts of cases, whether domestic violence or not, the homicides are the best thing that we have to trace, and they in fact appear to be down since implementation of the law. Before explaining the amendments in 400 and responding to the concerns that were raised immediately preceding my testimony, I guess I should give you a little bit of background about how the law works. It's three-tiered. It's first what the police do when they arrive at the scene of a domestic dispute. disturbance, and that is an issue in this bill. But they have to, if they have probable cause to believe that an assault has been committed, they have to arrest the suspected perpetrator of that assault. The idea is not to have police out there mediating anymore, but to separate out the parties. And there's been a lot of study, a very good project that was done in Duluth, or Minneapolis, excuse me, that's actually the very best way to intervene and stop future violence, is to separate them out. Okay, step two is what we're dealing with in Senate Bill 400, and that's the court response, and that is the restraining order process. And basically, the victim of domestic violence goes to the judge or the court, and there are forms available at the courthouse, and the procedure is free, and they fill out the forms, and then they're given a hearing that day or the next day, where they have to explain to the court what the alleged abuse was. And if the court finds that there's imminent and present danger of abuse, that the petitioner is endangered, then they can award certain relief. Now, when that order is entered, the respondent has time to respond and get a hearing on that explanation.